Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. It's wonderful to see so many, many of our own folks as well as many visitors. So I hope you all have been very welcome. Now, what I'm going to be tonight is the first in a series of four talks, and tonight is very much a scene setter. So it's looking at the background to the covenants, looking at that period in the late 16th century, moving into the early 17th century, looking at the earliest developments of Presbyterianism in Ireland, and looking at the covenants coming to Ireland. Next week, I'll be looking at the formation of congregations within the Presbyterian Church. I'll be looking at the work of David Houston and Alexander Peden in maintaining the covenanting principles. I'll be looking at the sort of silent age, a silent era in the history of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in the early 18th century, when really we know very, very little about the covenanters. Third week then we'll look at the formation of the first Irish Reformed Presbytery in 1763, and look at the work of William Martin, who was the first ordained minister in Ireland, first ordained Reformed Presbyterian minister in Ireland. And we're looking at the subject of the United Irishmen and the Covenanters, that subject in the late 18th century that dominated Irish politics and Irish history. What was the role of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in it? And it was surprisingly significant, actually, for a small denomination. And then the final week, I'll be looking at the last two centuries in the life of Collibaci, two centuries of congregational life. So then, where do you begin a study of the Covenanters? Well, let's begin with John Knox and the Scottish Reformation of 1560. In that year, the authority of the Pope was declined in Scotland, it was rejected, and the celebration of the Mass in Scotland was outlawed, and in essence Scotland became a country where the Reformed Church was in a position of strength and authority, recognised by the state as being a true church. Of course, the Scottish Reformation hadn't come out of nowhere, although we traditionally date it to 1560. There we are. Yay. You knew what happened in the end. 1568 hadn't, of course, come out of nowhere. There had been several decades where the ground was being laid for this very significant moment in Scottish history. The work of the likes of Patrick Hamilton, George Wishart, both of whom were martyred. The fact that a significant number of the Scottish nobility was sympathetic to the Reformation all prepared the way, and which in the end led to the significant event of 1560 when the Reformation took hold in Scotland. Knox regarded as being the key figure in that, and he certainly was. There were others as well, but Knox is certainly regarded as a pivotal figure in the Scottish Reformation. So we're thinking of covenants and, you know, the Covenanters. Well, from late 1550s, a traditional bond, like a band, a binding together, that would have been well known to the Scottish nobility, very important in terms of social binding, political binding, linking together of people with a common interest. That was given a religious significance. We have a series of covenants established from the late 1550s onwards. That's just some of the earliest, the Dun Covenant of 1556, the Godly Band of 1557, one of the most significant of the early covenants, the Perth Covenant, Stirling Covenant, and Leith Covenant. All of these were like a binding together for people with a common purpose designed to forward the Reformation in Scotland, to protect the Reformed Church in Scotland. Now, when we're thinking of covenants, it's important to bear in mind, I think I make this point, Robert McCollum makes this point very well, that the covenants were not like an additional to the Bible, that these were very much a representation of introducing biblical standards and biblical practices. Robert says, in swearing these covenants, the Reformers did not consider that they were binding themselves to anything additional to the Bible, but that they were additionally binding themselves to that which was already their duty to do so. So these were not introducing an innovation into worship or into scripture. These were additionally binding themselves to that that they already considered it the responsibility to do so. And the significance of these covenants, of these covenantal agreements, continued through in Scotland through the late 16th century. The most significant of all was the what's been termed the First National Covenant of 1581, also known as the King's Confession, and it's able to unite the people of Scotland in maintaining and defending the principles of the Reformation. This was a time when the Reformed Church was coming under significant pressure externally and internally, and this was a declaration to maintain the principles of the Reformation. And those who subscribed to it promised to continue in obedience to the doctrine and discipline of the Church now settled. In other words, the Reformed Church. It was widely signed across Scotland, popularly taken up. The King himself subscribed to it. He was only a 15-year-old boy when he did so, but the King himself subscribed to the First National Covenant of 1581. But Scottish history, religious history and political history in the late 16th century, early 17th century, it's extremely complex. And there's a real tussle between, on the one hand, those who want to see a Reformed Church based on the principles of Presbyterianism, where you would have kirk sessions, you would have presbyteries and synods and general assemblies, and those who wanted to see an episcopal form of church government. In other words, church government that was ruled by bishops and archbishops. So not power coming from below, as with the Presbyterian system, but power being imposed from above under an episcopal system. James VI, you would say, was someone who was particularly sympathetic to the episcopal system of church government. He was someone who really didn't like the Presbyterian system at all. He was committed to the episcopal form of church government. Now, the great champion of Presbyterianism as a form of church government in the late 16th century, was a man called Andrew Melville, a brilliant scholar, a brilliant academic, and a very key individual in Scottish religious history at that time. Certainly Knox had been extremely sympathetic to Presbyterianism, but Melville is regarded as the man who really championed it, and it was due to him that we see Presbyterianism become the dominant form of church government for a time in late 16th century Scotland. That's a Victorian representation of him upgrading a bishop at the court of James VI. You can see the king in the background on his throne. And I love this quote from Melville. This is Melville challenging the king in a debate in 1596. And he says to the king, "Sir, you're God's silly vassal. There are two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There is King James, the head of the Commonwealth, and there is Christ Jesus, the King of the Church, whose subject James VI is, and of whose kingdom he is not a king, not a lord, not a head, but a member. In other words, he's just the same as everyone else. No more authority should be given to him within the church as anyone else." But the fact is that gradually Presbyterianism was chipped away. You have bishops coming back into positions of authority. The king is doing everything in his power to turn the church into an episcopal church. And that is bringing the church and the state into very close, into a real confrontation. Great difficulties are arising between those who are Presbyterians, and those who are supporters of episcopacy. Melville is himself forced to leave Scotland. He ends up going to the continent where he dies. And this continues through the rest of the reign of James I. He dies in 1625, and again in the reign of his son, Charles I. Now, even more so than James, Charles was someone who wanted to bring all of the churches in the British Isles into much closer conformity. In other words, that the churches in Ireland and Scotland should be made to operate in the same way as the church in England. And the Church of England, of course, was an Episcopal church. And one of charged as chief lieutenants in this was Archbishop William Laud, one of the most significant figures in the English, the most significant figure in the English church in the 1630s. So even more so, they bring matters to a head. There are laws passed to outlaw sessions and presbytery. There are new rules and regulations enforced on the church. The king is given an even greater significance and prominence within the church. That, of course, is causing huge problems for those who are genuine in their Presbyterian convictions. One of the chief individuals in that regard is the Reverend Samuel Rutherford. He's born in the south west of Scotland, and he becomes minister here at Anwath in 1627. Anwath, this lovely little church, is just off the main road near Gatehouse of Fleet. If you're ever driving across from Carn Ryan to Dumfries, you only have to take a detour of about a mile and you come to this wonderful church ruin. You can actually see a little plaque above the door telling you that this was the church in which Samuel Rutherford was minister. And Rutherford was one of the champions of Presbyterianism at a time when Presbyterians were coming under severe pressure to conform to an Episcopal church. In the end, Rutherford incurs the wrath of his bishop, and he's exiled from Anwath to Aberdeen in the hope that there his views would be moderated. In fact, they're not. They're reinforced more than ever. And in the 1640s, Rutherford becomes a very important figure in defining Covenanter thinking. So Rutherford is one of those who is forced out, exiled to the northeast of Scotland. Now in 1637, new sets of rules and regulations for the Scottish Church are introduced. A new prayer book is introduced. Knox's and Melville's books of discipline, as they were known, are outlawed. And all churches are forced to use a new prayer book. On an important day in July 1637, Sunday the 23rd of July 1637, for the first time, the new rules and regulations, the new prayer book, is going to be introduced to the service in St. Giles in Edinburgh. And as the dean is rising up to read from the new prayer book, a riot breaks out. A woman called Jenny Geddes, according to tradition, picks up the stool on which she's seated and hurls it at the dean's head. And immediately the service is thrown into chaos. You can see a representation of it there. The Archprelate of St. Andrews in Scotland, reading a new service book in his pontificabulus, assaulted by the men and women with crickets, stools, sticks and stones. So uproar ensues. The service has to be abandoned. The dean and the other ecclesiastics have to be taken away for safety. That sets in motion a chain of events that leads eventually to a desire from the leaders in Scotland, the civil and religious leaders in Scotland, that they need to make a clear declaration of where they stand. There's no more submitting to the authority of the king in terms of the church. They have to take a stand. And that leads to the signing of the covenant, the National Covenant of 1638, the Scottish Covenant, as it's known. Much thought had gone into it, its preparation. Eventually, on the 28th of February, 1638, it's proclaimed at Greyfriars in Edinburgh. On the 28th of February, the nobility and gentry of Scotland sign it. The next day, the ministers. The days after that, the ordinary people. And within a very short period of time, copies of it had been taken throughout Scotland and had been subscribed to by the greater number of the people of Scotland. The popular reaction to it was tremendous. The two individuals could be regarded as the key architects of the covenant. Archibald Johnston, of Warriston, who was a Scottish nobleman. He called the 28th of February 1638 as that glorious marriage day of the kingdom with God. And the other key individual, the real brains behind it, you might say, was Alexander Henderson, who was a Church of Scotland minister, and the man who would become the first moderator of the newly constituted General Assembly. You see, the General Assembly hadn't met properly for 3 decades. The King would not allow the supreme body within the Church of Scotland to meet without his permission. And even those few occasions that it did meet, it was carefully controlled, and only certain people were invited to it, just to make sure the King had his will enforced at it. So Archibald Johnston and Alexander Henderson are the two key individuals. Now, what did the Scottish Covenant, what was the Scottish Covenant about? Well, first of all, there were 3 parts to it. Part one was the Covenant of 1581. It was included in its entirety in the 1638 Covenant. Part two, which was really the work of Archibald Johnston, listed the Acts of Parliament that had been issued or passed in favour of the Reformation. And it was vitally important because the Covenanters were very keen to show that they were not committing acts of treason, that what they were doing had a very clear legal basis. And they were going back then to the various Acts of Parliament that legally underpinned what they were now doing in 1638, so that no charge of treason could be levelled against them. And then the third part was an additional bond that was actually framed by Alexander Henderson. And it was framed to meet the needs of the time. And it promised to uphold true religion, defend the king and the preservation of true religion, liberties and laws of this kingdom, and that the present and succeeding generations in this land are bound to keep the aforesaid national oath and subscription inviolate. And so the last part is important. Present and succeeding generations in this land are bound to keep the national oath and subscription inviolate. And this gives a sense, this is the basis of the continuing obligation of the covenants. That it wasn't just something for the times in which it was framed, it was something that was to last for all time, the perpetual obligation of this covenant. And so note, it talks about defending the king. They were not seeking to depose the king. What they were seeking to do was to stop the king enforcing his will on the church, that the king should have no authority to dictate to the church. So that's where we leave Scotland for the time being. The national covenant has been signed, taken up across Scotland. Now, early 17th century Ulster witnessed significant changes at a whole range of different levels, political, economic and social. And it saw the influx of large numbers of settlers from England and in particular from Scotland. This map shows the way Ulster was divided up at the time of the plantation. And note there were really 2 plantations. There was an official, government-directed plantation in the west of the province, and then in the east, in Antrim and Down, there were unofficial plantations. And their settlement was very much the product of private endeavour. You may have heard of Hamilton and Montgomery in County Down, for instance. They were the drivers of plantation in north and east County Down. Round Antrim, the main driver of settlement was the Adair family. This shows their ancestral home in Scotland, Dunskey Castle, just outside Port Patrick, reached by a long clifftop path. It's one of those spectacularly situated castles anywhere in Scotland. It's well worth a walk up to the cliff just drops sheer to the sea. It would have been an amazing location, actually, in its day. That's the ancestral home of the Adairs. The Adairs acquire their estate in Ballymena around 1620. And in 1626, William Adair receives a patent to hold a market and fair in Ballymena. Now, it's really his son, Robert Adair, who's a man who actively develops Ballymena as an important town. He issues quite a few deeds for properties in the town to a variety of different tradesmen and craftsmen in the mid-1630s. And so it's under his direction that Ballymena takes on the shape of an important market town, the most important town in mid-Antrim. Well, at Galgorm, to begin with, we have a man called Sir Faithful Fortescue. He probably built the walls that we see here and the flanking towers that are just out of this photograph. But it's really his successor, Alexander Colville, the Reverend Alexander Colville from Fife, who's the man who builds Galgorm Castle, probably or possibly in the mid-1630s, certainly by the latter part of the 17th century. It's still, of course, still standing today and still occupied today. Around Collibaki, we really don't know very much about exactly what was happening at that time. We do know that in 1628, William Houston of Craig's Castle was the High Sheriff of County Antrim. Now, where was Craig's Castle? And in 1636, William Houston the Younger, maybe William Houston of Craig's Castle's son, was of Colney Baki, is referred to, William Houston Jr. of Colney Baki. And one of the earliest references to Collibaki, the earliest references to a Scottish settler in Collibaki. And so by 1630, what we see is a pattern of settlements across the province. You can see areas where Scots are clearly dominating, and areas then where English are more significant. So look at the Scottish areas, north and east down, sweeping across County Antrim. This would be Ballymena, just meant to be here slightly off location. Ballymoney up there, sweeping across the city of Londonderry into East Donegal. And that's very significant. Look at that distribution. And then look at the distribution of Reformed Presbyterian churches in Ulster. And it's a very significant clear correlation. Maybe apart from this area here in south, east down, south Armagh, sweeping into Monaghan. But certainly this area, sweeping across from north down, across County Antrim, into Donegal. So for the most part, where Reformed Presbyterian churches were established, it was in those areas where Scottish settlement had been most significant in the 17th century. Now, in the early 1600s, a number of Presbyterian ministers, you might say men of Presbyterian convictions, come to Ulster and take up positions in parishes. The first, traditionally the first, was here at Temple Coran. This is a church in which Edward Bryce preached. Edward Bryce is regarded as the first Presbyterian minister in Ireland. He came from Drummond in Stirlingshire and been invited across here by the Edmonstons, William Edmonston, who had established a Scottish settlement at Broad Island or Ballycarry in the early 1600s. Bryce was just the first. A number of others, maybe a dozen or more others, would follow in the ensuing decades. But it's important to emphasise the fact that they didn't operate within a separate and distinct Presbyterian church. Rather, there were ministers within the Church of Ireland, but they were allowed a degree of latitude to pursue their own religious convictions, to maybe establish kirk sessions within their parishes, to operate by the 1630s in a sort of presbyterial system that had been organised. Here are some of the churches that they established. So here, for instance, we have Robert Blair, a professor at Glasgow University, comes to Ireland in 1623 and takes up a position as minister in Bangor. At Holywood, we have Robert Cunningham. Ballycarry, I've mentioned, Edward Bryce. At Larne, and also over at Ballymena, we have George Dunbar. He'd come across from Ayrshire and become ministered in Ballymena and Larne. Antrim, we've actually an Englishman, John Ridge, and an English Presbyterian. Donegore, Andrew Stewart, Temple Patrick, Josias Wells, so I'll come back to those men in a moment. So we see a network of churches established in which there are men, they're ministering, they're Presbyterians, but not within a Presbyterian church, within the Church of Ireland. Here's two of the tombstones that you can still see today. Josias Welch at Temple Patrick. He was the grandson of John Knox. Comes across the Temple Patrick in the 1620s. Dies in 1634. And Andrew Stewart of Donegore, the man who was closely associated with Welsh, probably from Ayrshire, he again dies in 1634, and his tombstone is built into the side of the Church of Ireland in Donegore. Stewart's son was one of the earliest historians of the Scots and Ulster. His son was a man who famously described the settlers as being the scum of both nations. But what he's trying to do, and he did write it in late 17th century, was to emphasise how much things had improved since the earliest days. Andrew Stewart. Now, both of these men were very much involved in what was known as the Six Mile Water Revival. There we can see the Six Mile Water. This is the ruins of Antrim Castle. Six Mile Water. A revival begins there in the mid to late 1620s. It starts off because a man called Glen Denning, Presbyterian at Oldstone, began to preach in a way that roused up the people and left them in terror, convicted them of their sin, but yet he didn't have the ability to soothe their consciences, as it was said. He didn't have the ability to then take things further, to actually apply the principles of salvation. That was really the work of men like Josias Welch and Andrew Stewart and others, who then came in to take over and to complete what Glendinning had started. A lot of it was done under the patronage of the Clotworthy family. This is Sir John Clotworthy, who lived at Antrim Castle. It's just the ruins of Antrim Castle there. And the Clotworthies, though they were English from Devon, they were English Presbyterians. And they showed a lot of protection, or they offered a lot of protection and patronage to these early ministers. And after a while, the ministers begin to meet together. They had a monthly meeting at Antrim. And they discussed business. They had a held a talk. They would have had various religious services. And that's been regarded by some as the first presbytery, an unofficial presbytery, but the first sort of presbyterial system that had been established in Ireland. And it met in Antrim. I mentioned the fact that in Scotland, what brought matters to a head was the attempt by the king to bring the Church of Scotland into closer conformity with the Church of England. And we see the same happening in Ireland. And by the 1630s, the latitude that had been shown to these Presbyterian ministers like Welsh and Stewart and others was withdrawn. They either had to conform to the Church of England, in the Church of Ireland, of course, but they had to conform to the principles of the Church of England within the Church of Ireland, or they had to get out. They didn't get out, they were forced out. In the end, they were dismissed, deposed, silenced, as it was called, forced out of their parishes. Some went back to Scotland, but a group of four of these ministers, among them Robert Blair, decide they would actually establish a new colony of Scots in New England. So a ship was built, the Eagle Wing, and September 1636, it set sail from Grimsport in North Down. Now sadly, the ship never made it across the Atlantic. Severe storms buffeted the ship extremely badly. Those on board, the four ministers and around about 140 of their friends and family, took this as a sign from God that they should not continue on their way. Instead, they should return to Ireland and Scotland. And that they did. And they did make it back safely. They probably had made it about two-thirds of the way across the Atlantic. But in the end, they came back. All of them came back safely. And many of them then, the ministers then, returned to Scotland. The situation in Ulster was such that they simply couldn't continue. They were virtual outlaws at the hands of the state. Now, there was significant support in Ulster. Despite the fact the ministers had been forced back to Scotland, despite the fact that the Presbyterians were under severe pressure, there was still significant support in Ulster for the Scottish National Covenant. It's reported that copies of it had actually been brought across to Ireland and have been signed by significant numbers of people. Hundreds of people had signed the Scottish National Covenant. And with this comment, this wonderful comment from Sir George Radcliffe, not a so dim sighted that sees the general inclination of the Ulster Scots to the Covenant, the first recorded use of the term Ulster Scots. So the government is determined to do something about this, clamp down on this. And so it introduces what was known as the Black Oath. This was forcing all adult Scots in Ulster to take an oath in which they would declare their abhorrence of the Scottish Covenant. Those who signed it had to faithfully swear, profess and promise that I will honour and obey my sovereign lord, King Charles. I will not bear arms or do any rebellious, hostile act against him. I will not enter into any covenant, oath or bond of mutual defence without His Majesty's authority. And I denounce and abjure all covenants, oaths and bonds whatsoever. So they were forced to sign this, which is basically a repudiation of the covenant. Some did, but many didn't. Many went back to Scotland to avoid signing the covenant altogether. In fact, it was actually reported that so many people had gone back to Scotland in 1 year that there were not enough men to bring in the harvest. That's the significance of the significant number of those who actually went back to Scotland rather than sign the covenant, rather than sign the Black Oath. Now, one of those who was caught up in this was Robert Adair of Ballymena. Adair was a great supporter of the Covenanters. He himself had gone back to Scotland to avoid signing the Black Oath, and as a result, his lands were confiscated from him. His Ballymena estate was seized. But he does appeal to the king, and he says to the king that he had purchased an estate in Ulster, well actually it was his father who had done so, and at the hazard of his life planted it with British. It was the most barbarous place and receptacle of rebels, but he had transformed it into a place of civilization. He had gone to Scotland to care for his estate there in 1639. He had estates in, not only in Ballymena, but also in Scotland, a man with a foot in both kingdoms, someone who at ease in both Ireland and Scotland. And he was actually charged with high treason, charged with joining the king's enemies in Scotland and plotting a Scotch invasion and rising at Ballymena and Antrim. He was actually accused and charged with plotting a rising of the Scots in Ballymena against the king and against the state authorities. Now, Adair pleaded his case and eventually he was allowed his estate back. But these stories concerns that there were going to be risings among the Scottish people in Ulster were a very real source of concern to the authorities, the state authorities. There were rumours of risings, rumours of rebellions. It was said that some of them were going to be incited by beacon fires lit in Scotland, and then they would see them on this side of the North Channel. So the fact is, Ulster in the late 1630s was really, really in a very tense place. It was a powder keg situation. It only needed a small spark and the whole thing would explode. And on the 22nd of October 1641, it did explode. But it didn't explode because of the Scots. It exploded because of the Irish. The leaders of the Irish leaders in Ulster, were watching events with some alarm. They were concerned that what was happening in Scotland could also happen in Ulster. They were concerned that a more puritanical parliament in London was going to take away their own rights, their own religious rights. And so a planned show of strength took place. Now it quickly got out of hand, and quickly rebellion spread across the province. One of the places caught up in it was Clough Castle here, also known as Oldstone. And there, The Scottish settlers fled for safety, for protection. Surrounded by their enemies, they were forced to surrender upon promise of safe passage. That was honoured. They were allowed to go on their way, but on their way to Carrickfergus, some of them were still massacred. In response to attacks on the Scottish settlers, in April 1642, a Scottish army was brought to Ulster under the commands of Major General Robert Munro. Munro established his base at Carrickfergus, and from there he would have been sending his army out across the province. Now, accompanying the regiments under his command were chaplains, army chaplains. And in June 1642, these army chaplains, along with a number of elders who had been appointed within each regiment, met in Carrickfergus, and that's regarded as the first official presbytery in Ireland, June 1642. They met possibly here at St Nicholas's Church in Carrickfergus, although it's a Church of Ireland. In 1642, it had been used as the church, the Protestant church. It wouldn't have been any particular distinction. So it's possible, can't be absolutely certain, but it's possible that here at Carrickfergus in St Nicholas's Church, the first official presbytery in Ireland was formed, and formed by those army chaplains and a number of elders. And we see here the monument in Carrickfergus to that first presbytery. And in Church House in Belfast, there is the window, the Carrickfergus window, commemorating that first presbytery. Now, back to Scotland briefly. Because of the signing of the covenant, the National Covenant of 1638, that eventually led to what were known as the Bishops' Wars. Wars between the Covenanters and the King and his supporters. It resulted in a humiliating defeat for King Charles. The King then was forced to recall the English Parliament for support, but the relationship between the King and the Parliament in England was probably even worse than his relationship with the Scottish Covenanters. And eventually, the relationship between the King and Parliament breaks down completely. And that leads to the outbreak of the English Civil War, 1642. The English Parliament, however, needs help. It's no money. And so it looks to the Scots, thinking it can form a common alliance with them. And that leads to the drafting of what's known as the Solemn League and Covenant in 1643. A covenant between Scottish Covenanters and the English Parliamentarians. And the idea in this was not only to extend Presbyterianism to Scotland, it was also that it should be introduced in England and in Ireland. In other words, Presbyterianism should become the structure of church government throughout the British Isles. You see the figures here, quoting from Jeremiah, "Come, let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten." Again, the man who drafted this was Alexander Henderson, the Reverend Alexander Henderson. Now, essentially, in return for a promise to introduce Presbyterianism to England, the Scots would send an army to support the English Parliamentarians. Now, on the other hand, it's not something that we never really saw Presbyterianism introduced in England as the official form of church government. Lawrence Kirkpatrick, in his big book on Presbyterianism in Ireland, says it's probably not an oversimplification to say that the Scots emphasise the religious aspects of the covenant, while the English emphasise the political aspects of the same covenant. So, in other words, the Scots are more interested in religious significance of the covenant, but the English, it was a political alliance that mattered most. Of course, that was to eventually see basically the failure of the Solemn League and Covenant to make any significant impact in England. But it did come to Ireland. The Scots wanted it brought to Ireland, and the Scottish army in Ireland to subscribe to the Solemnican Covenant. And anyone else could do so as well. And in the spring, in early summer of 1644, the covenant is signed at 26 locations across Ulster. From Ballywalter in the Irish Peninsula to Ballyshannon in Donegal. And one of those places where it was signed was Ballymena. Here again we have a figure of local significance. Because the man who brought the covenant to Ballymena was the Reverend William Adair, the brother of Robert Adair. Adair was the minister and heir in Scotland, and this is this wonderful tomb to him in Ayr, in the old kirk in the town, this effigy of him kneeling in prayer, sadly being defaced, probably partly by vandals, partly I'm sure by the ravages of time. He has this wonderful life-size effigy in Ayr, where you can actually see, look at the man, right, as a representation, the man who brought the covenant. The man who brought the covenant to Ballymena. So the covenant comes about. There's Ballymena in the 1650s. It's not a place of immense importance. It's not, obviously, it wasn't nowhere near as large as it is now. Ballymena is still the most important town in all of Mid Antrim. So it comes in 1644. An account of its coming is provided by Patrick Adair in his narrative of the rise of the Presbyterian Church. Now, this is Patrick Adair, who was like a nephew of William Adair. Mr. Adair and Mr. Weir, the two ministers, visited first Antrim, and after that Ballymena, then a small garrison. In both places, God was signally present with the ministers and people, the Lord assisting the ministers in the work of preaching and explaining the covenant, and the people with much affection to receive it. The ministers were to direct to insist on sweet and suitable subjects thereon, as Ezra 8, verse 23, and Psalm 102, verse 13. So the covenant's taken up with great enthusiasm in Ballymena. No doubt, people from Cullibacky were present to receive the covenant on that occasion. So as I said, the covenant is taken to 26 locations across the province, subscribed to by thousands of people, not simply the Scottish army, but thousands of ordinary people as well. And at the presbytery that met in Bangor in May 1644, it was said that the number of persons who had signed the Solemnican Covenant was above 16,000, besides those of the Scottish forces. So 16,000 had signed the covenant in Ballymena. So we've moved from a situation where Covenanters, or the Presbyterians rather, are under severe pressure from the state to position, but they seem to be in the ascendant. Does that continue? Well, that's what I'll be covering next week. Thank you very much.